This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Welcome to Jikoji, those who haven't been here before. And I hope that if you get a chance to, if it's especially your first time here, you walk on the trails a little bit to enjoy not only this beautiful spring day, but the many ways that we've been enjoying it these last couple of days, Jiro and I, and the people who we had at a workshop this weekend for haiku poetry writing. I don't know if you've ever heard of haiku before, but it is a form of poetry that has a way of being seamlessly connected to our meditation practice here. Just like in Qinyin, when we stand up and walk, it's a form of meditation walking, the stillness moving through the room. Similarly, we are still as you walk through the grounds and notice, opening up our senses to experience what is not only outside, but happening and arising inside simultaneously and how they're so connected. And then we write about it. So that's what we've been doing. Haiku is only 17 syllables, so it's very, very condensed way of saying something. And it takes the narrative of our story that we see and just cuts through it and gets to the point and the essence of it and writes it down so that it's really interesting. Get you right into the moment directly so that you can see clearly and beyond the things that we normally the way that we normally look at things, we kind of open up to a way of seeing that's not habitual. So this is what we do when we're haiku walking, when we're haiku writing, and when we're reading haiku. We're connecting with the writer who has that moment, that haiku moment of just looking. No judgment, no trying to give a narrative about it, just giving our eyes, our ears, our whole body to this moment, and engaging with it fully, totally.
Well, a typical early poem from Issa, who was a well-known monk in Japan. In this sacred temple, even the snake has shed his earthly skin. And doing a Qinyin, or the slow walking meditation that we did, you might have noticed step after silent step. Yet the floor creaks and the birds singing joyfully.
And if you haven't noticed that, you've probably noticed something else. And it could be just your breath. And as Joe has mentioned in our haiku workshop, the haiku can be 17 syllables, but it can be just what comes up in one breath. And noticing that, whatever your thoughts are, whatever your visual, what is in your visual field. What's nice about the haiku walk is that you're outdoors. And so what we've noticed when we were in our workshop is that we had a rhythm. We'd come into the zendo and meditate and write haiku. And it felt a certain way. As we were writing, we kind of felt, okay, this is how this feels, and this is, you know, just a little bit more inward. Then we went out for a haiku walk, came back and meditated and wrote, and it just seemed to open up. The visual field was more open, the impressions seem a little bit more, instead of microscopic and staying there, it became magnified into, you know, it just opened up the whole poem. So it's nice to go for a walk, you know, even if you're not writing haiku, it kind of opens up and gives you space to kind of let things be seen from the eyes of not just your story, your personal agendas, your bias, but from the eyes of being connected to everything, everything outside, everything inside, and paying kind of respect to it, being very gentle with that respect. You know, you're not completely, you know, giving into it and falling onto the ground and but just go, there's a sangha everywhere I look. And how do we represent that in our poetry? How do we pay homage to that sangha right here on our cushion, as well as we're stepping on that sangha?
There's a similar perspective from R.H. Blythe, who was an Englishman who was stuck in Japan during World War II as a prisoner. And he studied Japanese culture extensively. And he wrote some books on haiku as well. The thing perceives itself in us. We perceive it by simple self-consciousness. The joy of the apparent reunion of ourselves with things, with all things, is thus the happiness of being our true selves. And he gives, for example, a very well-known haiku from Basho, the most well-known haiku poet in Japan. It's translated, of course, into English, so it loses something. The silence. The voice of the cicada penetrates the rocks.
In writing the haiku, whether we were indoors or outdoors, it seemed to me there was a shyness about it. Like as soon as you get close to what really you wanted to say, like turning away from it was not so unusual. Like get distracted about something else, maybe add a whole bunch more words. That kind of thing for me came up. And so I had to remind myself to keep turning back to what that first raw energy was, that first, the thing that I was shy about, the thing that was calling me, but I was kind of not wanting to hear it because it meant for me, I had to look at something that made me feel uncomfortable, something that wasn't so, maybe beautiful. You know, sometimes the things that aren't so beautiful are not easy to befriend. So similarly, there's a way in haiku is go back to the thing that you see, keep coming back to it. And here's a poem that was written a long time ago, and it has to do with that. You know, not just writing about the beautiful or the easy to look at, which is okay, but another option is to just write what you see. And keep coming back to it, you know, keep trying to clarify, is that really what I'm seeing? Because we could fool ourselves. I can easily, as a painter, and what we were experiencing last night with Jerome, Nenzen and I, Nenzen's learning calligraphy from Jerome, and so I'm watching how you have to paint just what you see, and it's so hard, really difficult. Similarly, very difficult to write what you're seeing without embellishing it with your narrative, your agenda, your judgment about it. So here we go with a haiku. Spring rain. In this new mud, the worm's pink skin. In spring rain, in this new mud, the worm's pink skin. Maybe not so attractive to some, but yet it's really saying what they're seeing and also has a tone to it. It's spring, it's talking about where they're at and the new mud. But Taikyu has a way of saying something very specific here, where they're at, it's what season they're in, what they're looking at, the color of it. But it's also saying something more. That's up to you, the reader, to imagine what that feeling is that that writer was trying to convey. So it gives you something to play with. It's not so, you know, it's not all giving in the words. It's alluding to things like the season, maybe to the what grows in that season.
Here, from our workshop, one of the participants took seriously the aspect of really identifying with what was being looked at. So here, this person is identifying with the leaves themselves. Brown, withered, I lie, sullied by wind, rain, footfalls. Brethren, to join me. So this leaf on the path probably is looking at and noticing the leaves above that will join him in due course, because that's the life of leaves.
Could you repeat it again?
Yeah. Murky pond. No, I'm sorry. Brown, withered I lie, sullied by wind, rain, footfalls. Brethren, to join me. And here is another one from yesterday. Murky pond, murky mirror, decaying quiet depths, dragonfly breaks the stillness.
One of the things that is noticeable in haiku is it causes an ordinary moment to expand into something greater, like taking this very mundane walk and noticing the leaves. It all of a sudden has a connection to something eternal, maybe transcendental, something beyond just this ordinary moment. Just like in Basho's poems, who comes from many hundreds of, well, not many, but hundreds of years ago, he writes a poem. Today, we read the poem and we connect not only with him, but something eternal. So in this particular Basho poem, on a withered bough, a lone crow perches. Late autumn. So you can recognize this man so long ago saw just what we see every autumn, you know, so not so, but yet there's something even more, you know, it's connecting us to something more somehow. And so few words we can do this. And it's a practice to cut through some of the just getting the right word. Like, for instance, could he replace the word crow with any other word? Could he replace the word withered bough with any other? It's an inevitable choice. It has to be that. Can't be anything else to get that same feeling that you may have experienced when you heard it. So in haiku, it's really distilling and being very, like it's the art of brevity, yet it has to retain something, it can't just be stale. We know what that feels like. So how do we keep it alive? How do we keep our practice alive?
And one aspect of that, which has been a strong element always in Japanese haiku, is that there should be some word which reflects the season. In Japan, there are clearly four seasons. California, we have two, if that. So for us, in a way, it's perhaps even more important to pay attention to the weather or to what's actually happening. Because it's our seasons are much more subtle, and it's nice to be connected to those subtleties. So if you talk about the withered branch, that sounds like autumn already. If you talk about there's one about muggy.
Muggy summer night. The summer is not necessary. You don't have to sit. It's redundant. Muggy is enough to give you a sense of the heat, the moisture of summer.
So in people who study haiku in Japan, they always get these long lists of words which are considered appropriate for each season. The words are called kigo in Japanese. So there's some for spring, summer, and so on. And it's very useful, because if every haiku says spring in it, it gets really boring. So they have many of these kigo words, or suggestive words. If we use fresh, for instance, that probably is going to be spring, maybe. So can some of you think of words that you could hear and you would probably immediately think springtime rather than some other time of the year?
Before going, I'll just give you some ideas so that you get a little sense of it. So you can break it down into season, sky, landscape, human affairs, animals, plants. That can be kigo. So plants could be whatever's growing this season. The poppies, cherry tree, the crocus. Landscape could be, so this is, instead of saying the word spring, we want to add some of these kigo. Red tide, that might be a spring word that you use, so that everyone gets, oh, this is a poem about spring. Dusk, lengthening days. And often it's in the first line that you would introduce the seasonal word, so that we can all gather. Where are we? Where is this poem taking place? What season? So any other suggestions for what comes up for you when you think about spring?
Blossoms.
Say louder.
Blossoms.
Blossoms. Perfect.
Butterfly dancing.
Yeah, butterflies dancing.
Eggs.
Eggs, colorful robin's eggs.
Chirping.
Chirping. We've been hearing that this morning. Lots of chirping.
Dragonflies.
Like the poem, dragonflies breaking the stillness.
Green.
Ripening.
And, Dro pointed out earlier that some of these words could transfer into another season too. So you might choose ripening and another spring word to, hone it down a little bit, because summer could be, especially in California, that could be all year round.
What about honeybees?
Honeybees. And you might even choose another just to bring it back into. But let me just check, Prachi, because it might be that that's on one of the animals. I don't see that as an animal or, an insect or anything, but certainly you could use it. And it, you see lots of them right now. So, but even bringing it closer to the to the moment, closer to spring somehow. Honeybees enjoying the, you know, the poppies or something. Each of those words that you've chosen, you know, doesn't it feel like it brings up something in you, like a tone? You notice how it feels in your body, those words. Unlike Christmas or, say, snow, that's a whole different feeling. You can combine them too. You don't have to say, oh, you can't have an autumn word in spring. You could combine them for the effect, so to juxtapose different things. But, you know, it's most common to keep it with one seasonal word, you know, thematically, to keep it harmonious. So I would like to read some of the poems that we came up with in one, which is dear to me, is by Giroux. And one of the reasons I like it, which you might also notice, is how there's a juxtaposition of images, which is commonly used in haiku, so that you have very clearly, distinctly different images, but it's harmonious. And it has a feeling when you do that, like it has energy. Radiant poppies, innocent among dried grasses, beside the lichened gray stone. Radiant poppies, innocent among dried grasses, beside the lichened gray stone. So we were up on the ridge yesterday afternoon, and when you're out there, it's not just you out there writing this poetry, you and all the insects, you and all the grasses, you and the sky, it's all coming onto the page, and it's amazing, you know, and then you get to share it. And so what we did is we shared our poetry afterwards, and if we were open to hearing any kind of, you know, suggestions, we had a clothesline, and we hung them on the clothesline, all our poems, and we would recite them out loud, and others would comment on them. And it was really nice, because sometimes you can be so close to the subject of your poem that you miss something. Like you're not aware of what others are reading. For instance, a poem that goes, "Every Christmas, my mother carries my arm from grave to grave." Well, you can just see an arm going from grave to grave because this author was so close to it. But all I had to do is change it to say, "Every Christmas, my mother carried me by the arm from grave to grave." And then that changes it all. So being careful, you can be too brief and not give enough information. And on the other hand, you could be overboard, which we didn't do yesterday because we were so careful. Death growing into sky, a tree returns to the earth. I hear wind whispers. This is in relationship to a beautiful old growth fir tree up on the ridge that we were sitting nearby, and this woman, Yukin, she was really moved by this ancient tree. Death growing into sky, a tree returns to the earth. I hear the wind whispers, it's like it's waving. Hiking up the sun-kissed hill. "Out of shape," says the thought voice. "Shh," the hill says. Sun-bleached grass sways. Planes fly by. Ancient fir holds its breath. Sun-bleached grass sways. Planes fly by. Ancient fir holds its breath. And just one more, who was written by someone in our Sangha, who's here, Marina. I don't see her, but everyone knows this about Dro. He whisks up all sorts of things. Dro whisks and whisks. Kindly accept his offer. Savor matcha taste. Dro whisks and whisks. Kindly accept his offer. Savor matcha taste.
Step, step, crunch. Broken twigs cushioned by decaying leaves.
So why don't we do questions? Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah, so haiku has a long history. There's many forms of haiku. There's fun haiku, there's serious haiku, there's tavern haiku. there's lots to explore. We were trying to explore more of the traditional forms in English and also incorporate contemporary and traditional. But as an example of a fun haiku, you could imagine the dragonflies again. And the poem says, "Dragonflies. My neighbor has more." And another, "Kids lemonade stand. For the crotchety neighbor, they double the price." So we'd like to open up the Sangha question discussion. You might have your own haiku that you'd like to share. And also, if you have any, not too difficult a question, because we're still students ourselves. Yes, Beck.
I am not too familiar with haiku. Thank you so much for sharing haiku and what it is about. I have a friend who does haiku at parties in the city. They come in and he types up haikus. And I wasn't really familiar with exactly what a haiku is until you explained it to me. Thank you.
You're welcome. Haiku had originally been kind of, not originally, but it developed into a party thing where people link verses, and it's a collaborative form of poetry. So someone comes up with the first line, someone who's skilled, and includes, you know, the seasonal word and some potent information, like a theme. And then the linked verse go on and on and on for thousands of verses. So it transforms, you know, but the theme tries to stay on target with the original first line, the hoku. Yeah. Yes.
Is haiku still popular in people in Japan? Or
it's becoming more written by women.
In modern life, yes.
Modern life?
Modern life.
I think it's still a form of poetry that more women are being involved in. It was originally all the greats were men, and now many more women are involved. But Dro has spent time in Japan. We could answer that more.
Yeah, every New Year's, the Empress announces the theme for the year. Mm-hmm. And then there's a haiku competition. And whoever wins the competition gets to read the haiku to the emperor. And then it's rather interesting because then now in the case of, it spreads to other arts also, like they make tea bowls, for instance, that echo the theme of the year. So it is still, an essential part of Japanese culture. I'm sure it's changing, and the people who are who are crazy about it. Maybe there are not so many young people, but I don't know right now how it's working. But anyway, it is still functioning in the culture.
In the spirit of the poem, I want to share this poem that was written by a Vietnamese monk about 100 years ago. I read this from a Thich Nhat Hanh book. The birds fly through the river. The river don't keep an image of the bird. The bird don't chase on the river.
Please repeat that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
A bird fly through the river. The river don't keep image of the bird. The bird don't leave chase on the river. To me, I think that's a poem about impermanence and also interconnectedness of life.
Beautiful. And what I heard too is how haiku can hold both the fleeting and the eternal simultaneously. And that really gives it such an impact, because all of a sudden you're like, oh, it won't be here. But like the fur, one's already gone and the other one's leaving. And it's like, oh, how could we honor it? How could we hold it and pay homage to the life it's given for this planet that we live on together? So haiku, any poem form, any device that we can pay homage to, show how privileged and how grateful we are to be together here in this very unique moment.
You mentioned a little bit as walking around the joy of reunion between kind of self and what's being recognized, and it's recognized. There's this beautiful transcendent quality, or in the haiku, taking an ordinary moment and sitting with it to get this essence that makes it more sacred, or and in therapy we have narrative therapy sometimes. Do you, or with poetry or with haikus, know if that's one of the applications, to be able to say, here's an experience that I've had a hard time not facing or looking at. Now I can sit until I come with a haiku in a way that helps me to have something to kind of get through it and get to, well, a spiritual place of acceptance or serenity or beauty or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the different arts are available to us, you know, to enable us to get through or to receive, to deeply understand our suffering or our problem. And certainly the haiku can be one of those.
I have a question for Julie. So awakening is when we extinguish our suffering. But for me, I take that teaching as, here is, I have a tree of suffering in myself. And if I can love that away from me, then I achieve awakening. But then I think more about it. Then I realize that that's only the suffering that I can be aware of. There might be other seed of suffering inside me that I don't know. So can a person ever truly achieve awakening?
He asked you.
I haven't yet. On the one hand, there is, in every moment, there is, the door opens for awakening. It may not be very deep, or it could be so deep you fall in and you get lost again and begin suffering. and it's available every moment. So I think if we just accept that reality, then we can relax a little bit without having the sense that we are trying to climb this steep hill and we're not there yet, and we're out of breath, and so on and so forth. So it's in a sense it's right before us.
The spirit of the moment and the eternal. I have a haiku that I wrote a few years ago. Space where Angie sat. All falls away, said Coben. Float, Zendo, float on.
That poem was written after sitting Sesshin, which you may learn about if you haven't yet already. And we've developed a little practice of putting whiteboards up in the dining hall and drawing Sesshin writing haiku. And Judy wrote that haiku drawing Sesshin, or in the midst of Sesshin, because things percolate while you're sitting. And it's nice to have a form for that, like to share, because we don't always know what's happening in each other while we're sitting in meditation practice, because we can kind of isolate and close into our little cave, and nothing is shared really. And that's an important part of the practice, but it's also nice to have a way to bring something that's alive in us on for others to see too. One of the questions about this practice of haiku writing that struck me was when I was working with a lot of grade school kids and offering haiku experiences for them. And I remember there's this young girl who had a beef with a young schoolmate, and we were in our circle writing haiku, and she said to me afterwards, "You know, I never liked that kid. He was always a bear for me." And after sitting with him during, because we would have tea and write haiku and I'd play flute, and she said, "Now I really like him because I see him differently." So it's space that's sacred with each other that I think can bring us closer together, and also space with the problems that we have to face. Whatever it is we're looking at that's difficult to look at, we bring space to it. And that makes all the difference. For me and for many, you know, we can get so clustered with so many things happening, and haiku could cut that away and just give us something to look at that's a lot more friendly. So in our writing together, in our sitting together, let's make friends with the difficult as well as the things that make us really joyous. That's not so hard to do, but to make friends with the things that are hard, that's what we're here for, each other, you know, to support that by giving each other space around it, by giving us a form to talk about it, share about it. So this kind of gives us back to the timelessness element of haiku. Basho is with us. In this haiku, it becomes, you know, that's thread is still with us from so long ago. I'm sorry to have to close early because I have to run, but it's been a real pleasure, but wait, Karin, you've got a question?
Oh, I just wanted to comment if there's still time.
Yeah, just one last.
So the question was...
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.